Welcome to Lung Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For our first lung cancer interview of 2010, I met with our favorite Renaissance oncologist, Dr. Corey Langer, who began our conversation by commenting on his work on the use of the anti-VEGF agent bevacizumab in patients with brain metastases.
As everyone is aware, ECOG 4599, which established the role of bevacizumab in advanced non-small cell, excluded patients with brain metastasis. And that exclusion was really orchestrated out of fear. There was no phase 1 or phase 2 data to actually show a safety signal, certainly not in advanced non-small cell lung cancer. There had been some instances of intracranial bleeding, I think, in some of the original phase 1 efforts. So it was clear from ECOG 4599 that some of the patients who did progress actually experienced CNS progression. There was no untoward incidence of CNS hemorrhage in that group. And if we do the numbers, it's probably about 15 to 25% of all of those who present with de novo stage 4 non-small cell, in fact, have brain metastasis. And in the bevacizumab era, we are pretty much obligated to obtain brain MRIs. So this particular study addressed the outstanding issue. Can bevacizumab be given safely in combination with either first-line or second-line therapy in advanced disease in patients who have had treated brain metastasis? And the key word here is treated, that the disease had to be stable or improved. The bevacizumab could be grafted onto the first or second cycle of treatment. The bottom line, with over 100 patients accrued, there were no untoward safety signals. There was one episode of bleeding that was probably unrelated to the bevacizumab. And as a result of this and actually other studies, the indication for bevacizumab is now expanded beyond non-squamous histology to patients with brain metastasis. Previously, that group had been excluded.
Anything you want to add in terms of brain mets? I noticed that you gave this prodigious, maybe that's not the right word, presentation at the ISLAC meeting about brain mets. I couldn't, it was just so much stuff in that. It was unbelievable. But anything in particular that when you kind of reviewed that whole topic you wanted to emphasize?
It's an exhaustive and exhausting area. It's a big problem, and it falls under the category I call undressed or neglected needs. 20% of patients actually present with brain metastasis, and they live long enough, probably close to 40 or 50% develop brain metastasis. So as we're doing better in non-small cell, the issue we previously observed in small cell applies just as much to non-small cell, maybe not as acutely and not as profoundly, but it's still a major concern. So there's a number of different issues. Number one, at least with respect to non-small cell, there was a very large phase 3 trial presented by Beth Gore and then just less than a month ago at the ASTRO meeting by Ben Moffsis, looking at prophylactic cranial irradiation in patients with stage 3 locally advanced non-small cell who had been treated either with chemoradiation or surgery plus chemoradiation. And the bottom line, PCI clearly reduced the incidence of CNS relapse, at least within the first year. The numbers dropped from about 18% to about 7.5% in the PCI group. Unfortunately, that has yet to translate into a survival benefit. And I think until or unless we actually see a bona fide survival advantage, unlike small cell, PCI will not be part of the standard approach in non-small cell, at least in locally advanced disease. One of the other issues, there was some memory decrements, some cognitive compromise 6 months and a year, which over time eventually got better, but that's still a major concern. The last thing we want to do is introduce additional toxicity. With respect to patients who already have established brain metastasis, there's a major RTOG effort that looked at patients who had solitary oligomets of 3 or less that showed an advantage for whole brain plus stereotactic versus whole brain alone. But I think clinical practice has begun to move beyond that. Patients with solitary or maybe 2 or 3, many of our colleagues, certainly many of our radiation oncology colleagues, are treating these folks with stereotactic or gamma knife alone and deferring the whole brain to later. And that peculiar issue needs to be addressed. There have been a number of trials, of course, that have attempted to add systemic agents to whole brain radiation, whether we're talking about temozolomide or metexafungadolinium or RSR13, various mechanisms of action, all looking quite promising preclinically. None, unfortunately, has yet to translate into a major improvement in outcome, whether we look at neurocognitive progression or progression-free survival or overall survival. There are many hints, but certainly nothing that's practice-changing.
Let's talk a little bit about small cell. We had Ron Natale on this program talking about the intergroup study that you were part of.
Well, small cell is a major source of frustration. I think we can safely say in the last 10 to 15 years, we've made very little headway. Certainly, the Japanese appeared to make headway. A landmark paper by Noda and colleagues showing a survival advantage for irinotecan and cisplatin compared to etoposides and cisplatin. It was about a 3-month improvement in median survival. There was about a 4-fold improvement in 2-year survival rate, and that certainly caught our attention in North America. There were 2 separate trials that attempted to replicate that. One was an industry-sponsored effort that altered the dose of irinotecan and cisplatin from the original Japanese trial, changed the irinotecan to weekly, and changed the platinum as well to weekly, try to capitalize on their putative synergy, avoid some of the myelosuppression that had been seen in the Japanese effort. Again, compared to standard etoposide cisplatin, absolutely no difference. Totally equivalent, progression-free, and overall survival, pretty much in keeping with prior studies, with median survival ranging about the 10 to 10.5-month target. Certainly, we're hoping for a lot better. One of the criticisms that Saijo and others from Japan raised was that we weren't dosing cisplatin properly, that we really needed to replicate the doses used in the Japanese trial. And so the large intergroup effort, which Ron Natale spearheaded, which was 4 times the size of the Japanese trial, essentially did that. It replicated the doses used in the Japanese effort, both for the control arm and for the irinotecan cisplatin arm. And once again, no difference whatsoever. Different toxicity pattern, less myelosuppression, but a lot more GI toxicity, particularly diarrhea. No difference in outcome with respect to response rate, progression-free survival, overall survival. Really can't tease out any subgroups that seem to have a preferential advantage with irinotecan. So this is a continuing source of frustration.
Getting back to the small cell and also the JCO paper looking at clinical and pharmacogenomic results with this SWOG-0124 study, anything that came out there that helped explain this difference in terms of what was seen with Japan and North America?
There are certain UGT1A1 differences, polymorphisms, that may bespeak a different capacity to metabolize this agent. And I think that ultimately affects both response and also toxicity. The irinotecan, in some cases, has been a bit more toxic in the Japanese. We've seen similar differences even with other conventional chemo combinations like paclitaxel and carboplatin in the Japanese. SWOG mounted a common arm analysis where they looked at trials done here in North America and trials done in Japan using the same doses of chemotherapy, the same basic patient substrate with respect to performance status, gender, and across the board, the same drugs used in the U.S. seem to work better in Japan. We see higher response rates, better survival, more toxicity, which is an intriguing duality.
Do you think that that's the primary explanation of the difference? Do you think it's maybe the study size contributed to it? Or, you know, what do you think the reason is?
I think that's part of it. But I think if you go back to the NOTA trial and are very careful about the nature of the enrollees, the irinotecan platinum arm may have had some subtle differences compared to the control arm that might have favored that group. Fewer patients who were PS2, fewer patients with brain metastasis, and a relatively small trial of 150 or so patients. Small differences like that can make a big difference in outcome. So it's purely speculative. Certainly none of those differences were statistically significant, but in aggregate, it makes you wonder. Still, I think the drugs are different. Another case in point, when we look at non-small cell, of course, is the EGFR TKIs. At first blush, they seem to work better in Japan, but as time goes on, it may be largely due to the fact that East Asians are more likely to have EGFR mutations, the activating mutation that closely correlates with response. And those folks, whether they get treated with an EGFR TKI or, for that matter, with chemotherapy, they seem to have better survival as long as they get treatment. Median survival times at 2 years or greater. And here in North America, though the percentage of patients who are EGFR mutation positive is generally lower than Japan, outcome when they receive identical agents, it's about the same.
So speaking of EGFR mutations, when I saw your editorial in the JCO about the Lazarus response, of course, I have to ask you about that. But first, how are things going with the poetry? Still go to the poetry club and all?
Yep, I still organize our monthly readings at the local Barnes & Noble, and we have workshops every month. You're invited if you're up here the third Wednesday of every month at 7:30 at the local library in Mercer County, right along the Delaware. But in any event, that's my one extracurricular activity. But I guess that has helped me when it comes to writing editorials. So, you know, that was an amazing paper. The Japanese, again, looked at gefitinib in a population with relatively poor protoplasm. PS2 patients included PS3s and PS4s. These are individuals we typically would not treat. All had EGFR mutation. You can bet there were many PS2, 3s, and 4s who perhaps didn't last long enough to even get their mutation testing done. Remember, they're not necessarily part of the denominator, but at least those who were tested, who were mutation positive and received gefitinib, their outcome was just about as good as you'd see with PS0 and 1. So the notion that a single agent, that an oral drug, which 10 years ago was hardly on our radar screens, can actually resurrect these patients, bring them back to life, certainly not cure them, but give them a meaningful quality of life and response and extended survival for 8 months, a year, sometimes 2 years. This is novel. And I think we had two questions. Was this real or were the results too good to be true? But I think anecdotally, at least here in North America, we've seen similar patients. And they're mostly anecdotal. There are no formal phase 2 trials looking at PS3 and PS4. I imagine some of those are ongoing. But it's clear that if a patient is mutation positive and who's certainly not a chemo candidate, you should have no compunction whatsoever about administering an EGFR TKI.
I guess that assumes the patient gets to an oncologist and they get the EGFR test done. I just wonder, are there people out there who are just dying without that opportunity?
I suspect that's the case, and I think it's important and reemphasizes the necessity that all lung cancer patients, even those who seem to be in desperate shape, have at least one oncology consult, whether it's in-house in the hospital or as a outpatient, to automatically assume that they're going to deteriorate and die very quickly is a misplaced assumption.
You know, it's amazing how quickly things are going in lung cancer. I wrote a piece recently called "Is Lung Cancer the New Breast Cancer?" Maybe somebody else has had that thought too. I don't know. But, you know, it's interesting. You wrote this. This was published in March. And yet now, less than a year later, there's actually a lot of new stuff. And particularly, I noticed in your paper, you brought up the issue of FISH testing. And a lot of that stuff came out at ASCO with IPASS. Where are we right now from your perspective in terms of EGFR mutation testing, when and who should it get done on, and really what does it mean in terms of first-line therapy in any patient?
Well, I think based on IPASS, which of course was just published in New England Journal, those who test positive for EGFR mutation should clearly be offered the opportunity to receive an EGFR TKI up front. Is it mandatory? The answer is no. If you go back to the IPASS paper and specifically look at survival, which admittedly is still somewhat premature, the amazing response advantage and PFS advantage has not yet translated into survival advantage. And of course, those who are mutation positive, get chemo up front, will by and large cross over to a TKI. But it spares patients the toxicity of chemotherapy, still dealing with diarrhea and rash. But I think as time goes on, we get a lot more intelligent about how to deal with these toxicities, certainly manage them more effectively. And the progression-free survival in some cases exceeds a year or more. You go back to the curves from that paper, the overall curve was significant, but particularly in the mutation-positive group, we're seeing hazard ratios we'd never observed before in favor of gefitinib. And there's no cytotoxic combination I can think of that's going to generate a resist response rate of 65 to 80%. Absolutely nothing. So the mutation-positive group has clearly segregated out. Everything else is pretty much a muddle. You go back to the original BR21 paper, simple IHC seemed to separate out those who appeared to benefit from those who didn't. IHC-positive patients receiving erlotinib had a significant survival advantage compared to placebo, whereas a subgroup that was IHC-negative didn't appear to have that. And the reverse seemed to be true of KRAS. Those who were KRAS mutants seemed to do worse, but again, the numbers were so small, the differences weren't statistically significant. But as time has gone on, and we've looked at other trials, in some cases larger trials, whether we look at either the antibody or the small molecules, neither KRAS nor IHC has really been borne out. There's still some lingering questions, but the issue is not yet settled, but increasingly it looks like they're not going to be major determinants. One thing we can say, those who are KRAS mutant, by and large, are not EGFR mutant. The two are virtually mutually exclusive. The murkier story is FISH. Certainly the data from SWOG suggests those who are FISH positive who are receiving an antibody, in this case, cetuximab, may have a preferential advantage. The progression-free survival, the disease control rates, and for that matter, survival were significantly higher in FISH-positive patients receiving concurrent chemotherapy, in this case paclitaxel carboplatin with cetuximab, compared to the FISH-negative group receiving the same chemo combination. And SWOG is actually addressing this. They're doing a huge phase 3 trial, chemo du jour, in this case paclitaxel carbo, with bevacizumab if you're eligible for Bev, and the major question is, does cetuximab add to this? So it's a plus-minus cetuximab trial, and it's separately powered to address the FISH question, to see if FISH-positive patients have a preferential benefit. On the other hand, if we go back to the FLEX trial, which compared vinorelbine cisplatin cetuximab to chemo alone, or the 099 trial that was spearheaded by Tom Lynch that compared PAC-carbo cetuximab to PAC-carbo alone, neither FISH nor KRAS nor IHC testing had any bearing on outcome.
We actually worked with Tony Mock, who's the PI on the IPAS study at ISLEC for the first time, really smart guy. And he had this slide kind of getting into this issue of EGFR mutations versus FISH, at least as it relates to EGFR TKIs. And kind of what I came away from that was that FISH really didn't add anything, because if you were FISH positive and EGFR mutation negative, the TKI didn't help. Is that the way you read it?
That's my reading, too. There was close correlation between FISH positivity and mutation positivity. So actually, FISH positive patients did have PFS benefit, but it was not as pronounced as mutation positive patients. So it added absolutely nothing. It sort of mimicked, but less profoundly, the results seen with the mutation testing.
Right now, how do you approach selection of first-line systemic therapy in patients with advanced squamous and adenocarcinoma?
For the standard patient up front who presents with de novo metastatic disease and has squamous histology, I've been favoring gemcitabine generally in combination with carboplatin.
With cetuximab?
Rarely, mostly just chemotherapy alone. For the patient with adenocarcinoma, predominantly adenocarcinoma, we've been using carbo in combination with either paclitaxel or pemetrexed. And again, if they're bevacizumab eligible, we've been grafting that onto the combination. I've been particularly impressed by the Hensing Patel data out of Chicago looking at pemetrexed in combination with carbo and bevacizumab in eligible patients. Again, granted phase 2 data, limited institution, but some of the more impressive data we've ever seen. There's an ongoing phase 3 trial in bevacizumab-eligible patients comparing pemetrexed to paclitaxel in combination with carboplatin and bevacizumab. Of course, the maintenance regimens are somewhat different. In the standard arm, it's bevacizumab alone, and in the Patel-Hensing arm, it's combination pemetrexed and bevacizumab. So that's a very popular trial, at least in talking to those who are managing the effort. I believe it's accruing ahead of schedule. ECOG is asking an equally important question. Hopefully, the trial will open shortly. In patients who've already received the ECOG 4599 regimen, paclitaxel, carbo, and bevacizumab, who are free of progression after 4 cycles, they'll be randomized to bevacizumab alone, you can argue the standard arm, versus pemetrexed versus the combination. And I suppose if you're a purist, you'd argue that there should be a 4th arm observation alone with crossover perhaps at the time of progression to the combination. But this is the United States, and that sort of trial with 4 arms and a control group receiving nothing would just not fly. It might work in Canada, probably almost definitely work in Europe. It wouldn't accrue here in the U.S.
And I've been hearing a lot more from investigators, I think like about over the last year, about this, you know, carbo, PEM, BEV first-line therapy. I know a lot of people are using it. I'm not really sure what people are doing off-study in terms of maintenance, whether they just give BEV, they add in PEM. How do you approach it?
Well, the original Patel-Hensing data actually used maintenance pemetrexed and bevacizumab in combination after six cycles. So both Tracy Evans, who works with me, and myself have pretty much patterned our approach after the Patel-Hensing approach. We realize there are no phase three data out there to necessarily support this regimen as superior. Those data are pending. I think we can probably assume that there's a toxicity advantage. Certainly, pemetrexed doesn't have the neuropathy and the potential for HSR that's typically seen with paclitaxel. But this has not been a uniform feeling, at least amongst the thoracic community. We're also separately completing a phase two trial. Jamie Stevenson, one of my colleagues at Presbyterian University of Pennsylvania Medical Center, had started a trial when he was at Cooper using the same three-drug combination, but then using bevacizumab maintenance alone. He did not use pemetrexed in the maintenance setting, and that trial has now been opened at University of Pennsylvania. We're about five or six patients shy of actually completing accrual. So hopefully that effort will corroborate the data observed by Patel and Hensing. And I guess the big question, if it looks as good, is whether you need both drugs in the maintenance setting. I think that's still unanswered. If we go back to Chandra Balani's presentation at both ASCO and World Lung, where pemetrexed yielded a five-month improvement in median survival in the non-squamous population, particularly the adenocarcinoma population, as maintenance treatment, got to remember the patients recruited to that effort did not receive pemetrexed up front as part of their initial combination, nor did they receive bevacizumab. So it's still a bit of an open question. Does maintenance therapy with a drug you've already used as part of the initial induction treatment, if you will, or initial metastatic regimen, does maintenance with the same agent lead to an improvement in outcome that we observed in his study when you used a different chemotherapy combination up front?
You know, another issue about EGFR mutations and TKIs that comes up is the issue, which really we're starting to see some interesting stuff come out on mechanisms of resistance, what you do. They're now, quote, irreversible EGFR inhibitors out there as a BIBW, I think 2922. What about this whole scene and what about this new class of agents?
Well, I think it's very important, but I think we have to put it into some degree of perspective. Remember, at least in North America, only 10 to 12% of patients are mutation positive. So we're talking about a niche population. Having said that, reversing resistance or preventing resistance, I think, are very big issues, at least within that group. The Boehringer-Ingelheim drug, as you pointed out, may have potential advantages over conventional EGFR TKI. It remains to be seen. There's a big phase three study comparing this agent in mutation-positive patients to standard chemotherapy, in this case, pemetrexed and cisplatin up front. We're actually going to join that trial, and this gives me some degree of trepidation because the last time I administered cisplatin to a stage four incurable patient had to be, I would say, about 15 years ago. Carboplatin, as far as I'm concerned, is still part of the standard regimen, at least in North America. But having said that, this is a group presumably is going to be a bit healthier, and certainly the data for the pemetrexed combinations with cisplatin. We've seen the arrival of other agents that may help prevent resistance. The MET inhibitors, IGFR inhibitors for that matter, are being looked at. There's an ongoing trial in the second and third line, actually in a non-adeno population, looking at erlotinib plus or minus the fidutumumab, the IGFR monoclonal antibody, which at least in phase two pilots looked quite promising in combination with standard chemotherapy with paclitaxel and carboplatin. It remains to be seen, though, whether any of these agents are going to add to our therapeutic armamentarium. I think potentially far more intriguing are the new oral agents targeting ML4-ALK from the Boston group, from MGH. Single agent in patients who have seen quite a bit of prior therapy. By and large, non-smokers or former smokers, again, all adenocarcinoma. those harboring the ML4-ALK fusion protein seem to be quite sensitive to this agent. The response rate numbers look as good as erlotinib in patients with the EGFR mutation. Still very early, but here too, there is a phase 3 trial that's starting up that'll compare this agent to standard second-line chemo in the second-line setting, and the primary endpoint is progression-free survival. The investigators quite properly realized that it would probably be unethical not to offer this agent to patients who have the fusion rearrangement. And so there's a companion trial that will enable patients who have progressed on chemotherapy to go on to the small molecule, the oral agent, at the time of progression. So under those circumstances, survival obviously can't be an endpoint, and PFS makes sense. So I think as time goes on, our understanding, particularly of adenocarcinoma, has really evolved. You go back 10, 15 years ago, they were all lumped together. We made very little distinction, frankly, between any of the subtypes of non-small cell. The Scagliotti data has forced us to rethink about histology with a preferential benefit for pemetrexed and non-squamous and gemcitabine in the squamous population. Of course, bevacizumab, with the exclusion of squamous histology, has also forced us to rethink along histologic lines, and it's absolutely imperative that our pathologists be involved in the process. NSCLC NOS is no longer an acceptable diagnosis. If they've got sufficient tissue, they really need to work it up and at least give us their best guess as to the full nature of the histology. But going beyond that, at least when we look at adenocarcinoma, there are a number of relatively mutually exclusive mutations that exist. Those who have KRAS mutation don't seem to have EGFR mutation. Those who have EML4-ALK likewise don't seem to have EGFR mutation. And as time goes on, I think we're going to see basically a tidal wave of these agents. We're going to be able to target each one of these and eventually perhaps do that in combination with some of the other more standard systemic cytotoxics. So I hold a lot of hope, at least in adenocarcinoma squamous. We've not been able to differentiate the way we have with adenocarcinoma, and it's still a major source of frustration. It may be also a relatively more homogeneous disease.
Yeah, I actually chatted with Alice Shaw for this program about the EML-ALK story, and I have to say, if I'm a non-smoker without an EGFR mutation, I think I'm going to try to figure out a way to get tested and maybe get in one of those trials.
Absolutely. And certainly that sort of patient is frequently quite savvy about this. So the trial that's just getting going, I think the processing time is less than 7 to 10 days. And certainly if you have a patient that's a non-smoker or a minimal former smoker who's got adenocarcinoma, particularly if they're negative for KRAS and EGFR mutation, they've got a fairly high chance of actually having the ML4-ALK, probably on the order of 20-25%. All comers, though, it's only about 4%.
Right. And, you know, you mentioned this issue of adenocarcinoma histologically, which now, I mean, this is a major marker that we need to think about. And yet, I mean, there was a paper at ASCO and there have been others before that. I'm not really sure what kind of information we're getting about that. I mean, can pathologists actually differentiate this?
They can do a good job when it's obvious. Certainly a moderately differentiated adeno that still retains the glandular features, shows some mucin goblets, that's not too tough to figure out. In fact, I can probably identify it under the microscope, and I don't pretend to have pathologic abilities. Same holds for squamous. You see keratin pearls, you see intracellular bridging. It's pretty obvious. It goes back to our days in histology during medical school. But a lot of these patients have poorly differentiated cancers, and it truly is difficult to distinguish the two. And here again, we do have markers. They're not ironclad, but if it's TTF1 positive, more likely than not, it's adenocarcinoma. If it's P63 positive, more likely than not, it has squamous features. It may not be a pure squamous, but it may be a mixed adenosquamous, but at least it begins you thinking down the squamous pathway. So I think it's imperative that the pathologists be enlisted as part of the multidisciplinary team. We've previously thought of lung cancers, including the medical oncologist, radiation oncologist, surgical oncologist, of course, radiologist. But in the last 5 years, pathologists are every bit as integral to that team as any of the other disciplines. And most of them are signing on. They welcome the challenge, and they realize that NOS, if you have anything more than just a few cells to base a cancer diagnosis, that NOS is insufficient.